Welcome to The Dark State, the podcast where we delve into the intricate world of international affairs, espionage, and geopolitics. I'm your host, John Mooney, and today we'll be exploring a pressing issue that has been capturing headlines and steering debate across the globe: the looming threat posed by Russia to Europe and its political implications for Ireland. Joining us as our esteemed guest is James Nixey, a seasoned expert in Russian affairs at Chatham House, the Royal Institute of International Affairs. From diplomatic maneuvers to military posturing, cyber espionage to disinformation campaigns, we're going to try to dissect the strategies and the tactics employed by Russia and examine how they impact on Ireland's national security and indeed further afield. So fasten your seatbelts as we embark on this enlightening journey through the complexities of international relations in the dark state. Before we begin, could I take a moment to thank everyone who subscribes to the show on Patreon, Apple Podcasts, and Spotify, where subscribers get access to additional episodes and briefings. And if you want to contact me, please message me on Signal at +353 89975 3779. James, welcome to The Dark State. Could I begin by asking you the following? What are the primary geopolitical goals driving Russia's actions in Europe, and how do they manifest themselves in its foreign policy approach?
Right. John, thank you very much for having me. It's a real pleasure to be here. Let me get straight to your question. Russia's primary geopolitical goals, because they really are antithetical to the liberal Western dynamic, to how we want to live our lives in the Western ordered world. And I'm afraid they're not some things that can be compromised away in some sort of negotiation. The reality is that Russia has long felt, and I mean long, by which I mean stretching back into Soviet times, of course, and Tsarist times, but even having lost the Cold War in 1991, that it is still a great power. And of course, it's the largest country in the world. It has been until recently an energy superpower. That's a diminishing asset, naturally. But it inherited a permanent place on the UN Security Council. It has more nuclear weapons than any other state in the world. So by some claims, that is actually correct. Unfortunately, Russia's ambitions, aims, and appetites do extend beyond its territorially agreed UN legislated borders. By which I mean that it still believes that it has an empire, and its empire, unlike say the British Empire, which was far flung overseas. Russia's empire, of course, was largely, even though it fought for influence in Latin America and Africa in the Cold War, Russia's empire, of course, was in its backyard, in the countries that more or less were on its borders, and it still requires acquiescence from these countries and first dibs, so to speak. It still thinks that these countries are either artificial creations, that they were an unfair that they left the roost at the end of the Cold War and that they simply don't hold the same status for Russia as other states in Western Europe do. And this has been, I'm afraid, a point of contention. It wasn't helped, I have to say. I mean, I don't want to go on too long, John, but it wasn't helped by George H.W. Bush's Chicken Kiev speech back in 1991, in Kiev of all places, when he beseeched Ukraine and other countries not to stretch too far and too fast for their independence. But of course, that is what they wanted. Having lived under the Soviet yoke for so long, then they were desperate to exude their national proclivities, their distinctiveness, which had been suppressed culturally, religiously, gastronomically, whatever, for so long. So, unfortunately, this tendency has simply has cut right through the 1991 division and has come to a head. It was always there, to be perfectly honest with you. It was there back in the 1990s under Yeltsin. But, you know, if you were to ask, for example, why did Putin invade 2 years ago? It's because he wasn't getting what he wanted diplomatically, economically. And so he had to resort to the most extreme action to get his what he feels are Russia's rights in terms of a gathering of Russian lands, a greater Russian empire.
So how significant is this military buildup and assertive behavior of Russia, say, for example, along its western borders for the security dynamics of Europe? We're listening to lots of commentary coming from the Baltic states. And sometimes in this part of Europe, we kind of think, is this hyperbole? Is it, you know, maybe people reading these matters wrong? But from what you're suggesting, the threat posed by Russia to countries like Latvia and Estonia is quite significant and, but more importantly, very real.
I'm afraid you're right. Russia has shown itself to be interested in Western and Eastern European countries alike in ways which are simply not permissible if you believe in your territorial integrity and sovereignty. And so it has tried to insert it. I mean, sometimes I'm sure you've come across the term hybrid warfare. Hybrid warfare is warfare, by the way. I mean, it's simply by non-kinetic means. And so Russia has for a considerable amount of time now inveigled itself in different ways in a multi-spectrum approach into the politics and society of Western states. In my country, in the UK, this has been very clear, as you will have seen from the issues of London Grad and the way in which we welcomed Russian billionaires and their money, no questions asked, into the country, and then found ourselves saddled with these people and that money, which, of course, we liked. We didn't like the corruption, but we liked the money. When the war came along, this was politically uncomfortable, and they're starting from a very low level in trying to deal with it. But it doesn't have to be. It doesn't have to be this particular way. Of course, if you are closer to Russian borders, and you mentioned the Baltic states, and you're absolutely right, then, of course, naturally, you're going to fear a more muscular Russian attitude than you would if you're in Ireland or Portugal, because that's just not viable for Russians to do that in that respect. But the Russians will simply do what works, and what wasn't working in Ukraine meant that they had to change to kinetic warfare. But it actually does work, and it's been seen to work in different states in different ways. Russia does not have a one-size-fits-all approach. It probes and it finds well. And if something is not working in one state, it won't work in another. Take the United States, for example. Last time at the presidential elections, when Donald Trump won in 2016, they very much used disinformation and electronic warfare. That probably won't be as successful the next time around because the Americans are more aware of it. But of course, they use other tactics as well. They've got Tucker Carlson on their side, naturally. So that was a useful piece of pre-election for Russia propaganda. But my point is that Russia, in its bid to dominate the world stage and to be respected in Russia's definition of world respect, unfortunately, gets involved in not just in the business of the post-Soviet states, as we call them, you know, the Central Asian states, the South Caucasus states, Ukraine, Belarus, Moldova, but actually way beyond. Very few places, if any, are completely untouched by Russia these days.
And it should be noted, we had Calder Walton on some weeks ago, and Calder was kind of making the point that all of these operations are only assessed on the basis that they may be successful. Finance isn't withheld. The decision to use whatever tactics it is to undermine an enemy state is based on its effectiveness. It's not money. So they're pretty determined about doing this type of activity.
That's exactly right. Money is not the most important factor here. As you can tell, Russia's war in Ukraine is costing it dearly economically, but it feels that it's worth the cost because these are ultimately, I'm sorry to say, ultra-nationalist conservatives who believe this is their God-given right. And so as a result of which, they are willing to expend blood and treasure, 400,000 Russian lives, and to suffer a far diminished living standard for a population, which once upon a time Putin was promising them far increased ones, because the issue of bringing Ukraine back into the Russian fold is preeminent. So it doesn't have the same cost ratio analysis that we do. And the thinking is quite alien to us, because we think of these people as being, we think of people as being rational actors, and perhaps they are on their own terms. But it is inconceivable to us as liberal democracies that we would expend so much of ourselves on this territorial reacquisition. And so I think that's why policymakers in the West find it hard to come to terms with. And the reality is they didn't want to accept that this was the case prior to Russia's invasion or reinvasion in 2022. And they used the excuses that we must, you know, look for areas of cooperation and they will branch out. And if you get the low-hanging fruit, then the more difficult stuff will come. But the reality was that they simply didn't get the fact that Russia had demands which were incompatible with the Western liberal order.
And I suppose, I don't know whether you'd agree with this, but this is a classic case of one side applying their own psychology to the other, and they really don't fit.
I absolutely would agree to that. And I think the Russian psychology is so alien that non-specialists often simply don't see it. It's an entirely different way of thinking. And it sounded, at least in spite of Russia's long list of crimes and misdemeanors, in spite of polonium attacks, Novichok attacks, assassinations, mysterious fallings out of windows, somehow that was always just seen as, oh, well, that's just typical Russia. It's not really serious. And it became a little bit more serious, it would seem, in February 2022. And there was a scramble to get our acts together. But we were starting from a very low base. And to turn around our country's psychologies and to use weapons and to send weapons which would be used against Russia was a turnaround, especially for countries such as Germany with its traditions. But I'm afraid that there is still a great deal of complacency. Because it's such a complex, wicked problem, we are patting ourselves on the backs because we have made unprecedented policy acts towards Russia. But the scale of the problem is now clearly so much larger than anybody or than most politicians had ever envisaged that we're struggling to keep up with the Russians.
James, could you elaborate on the role of hybrid warfare, including cyber operations and disinformation campaigns, and Russia's strategy towards Europe? We're now heading into European elections, local elections, certainly in Ireland and other countries.
Yeah.
How much of a problem is this? Could Russia become in the midst of all of this?
It really could be. There are some states, some Western states, where the choice between parties in elections is quite stark. For example, in France and in Germany, then there is a serious risk of the far right winning a legitimate election. When the balance is so fine, and America actually in 2016 is another good example, when the balance is so fine, then it doesn't take a lot to tip it over. So you asked about the role of non-kinetic or hybrid warfare. So kinetic warfare is really only a quarter of the Russian idea of warfare. It also encompasses diplomatic, economic, and informational/cyber warfare. And there are different ways in which Russia can do that. Obviously, we know that the troll farms that operate out of St. Petersburg, for example, which using enhanced AI techniques are able to increasingly ape and imitate Western people and expose, what they tend to do is expose pre-existing fissures in our societies. So, for example, in America, that might well be the race issue, or it could be the gun control issue. In the UK, it could conceivably be the Brexit issue. In Europe, it could be far-right immigration issues. And so it can just tries to shift the dial almost subtly, certainly attemptedly, invisibly, into exposing those fissures, creating more discord, creating disunity, in the hope that that will reflect itself in ultimately more Russia-friendly governments in the West. And quite clearly, in, to say the case of France, Marine Le Pen's government, which has taken money from the Russians explicitly, admittedly, would be far more amenable to the Russian order of things, and cares very little for the independence and sovereignty and territorial integrity of Ukraine. So Russia is able to do that, but I must say that it is extraordinary how far Russia's tentacles reach. They will do this in as far in, you know, as you know, they have been known to manipulate elections as far away as Madagascar. They are clearly involved in the drug trades in Argentina. They have been, you know, we obviously know that there's a sort of autocracies of the world unite aspect, and they are, I think Lavrov was in Venezuela this week, if I'm not mistaken. So we started out talking about Estonia, Lithuania, and Latvia, but the reality is that all countries feel it one way or another. And you told me before we came on air, John, we were talked about the ways in which Russia was interfering in Irish politics and society, and I think most countries of the world would be able to identify with that problem.
With regards to Ireland specifically, what vulnerabilities or strategic interests make it potentially vulnerable to Russian influence or interference? We're on the western coast, as you know, of Europe. We're largely unprotected. Our defence forces have been emasculated beyond belief. I think it is a view of the security services and the military here that we are certainly in being sized up and reconnoitred, etc., for lots of different things. I'm not talking about a kinetic attack or anything like that, but possibly interference of some type, possibly sabotage, possibly you've got Russian figures reaching out to dissident Republicans, possibly right. reaching out to far-right extremist groups that are emerging and developing here at a rate that I think has shocked everyone. So could you maybe talk me through what would interest them about Ireland?
So I don't know Ireland well, and I don't have a good understanding of its politics and society. But it seems conceivable to me that Ireland's defences are a little bit down. It has orientated itself in a certain way, maybe against terrorist threats over the past few decades, and it has a complete understanding of that, and that Russia is something new, and something that was relatively untouched, even in the Cold War. Even in the Cold War. And so I think to a certain extent, there's the sheer freshness of it is one thing. But at the end of the day, Ireland is a member of the Western Community of Nations, and if anything which uses up bandwidth in terms of disruption is ultimately useful to Russia, so that it can concentrate in other areas where it wishes to do so. So I think that it's simply the case that there is no country in the world, although Russia is looking to China as a new ally, and obviously it's getting weapons from Iran and North Korea right now. But in terms of the West, then Ireland is probably not exactly target number one. That is obviously Ukraine, and it does tend to draw out geographically from there. But I don't think it should be complacent. But it's too far away, separated by the Irish Sea or the UK or from the continent of the mainland, because these things don't matter anymore. And that Russia will, the reality is that hybrid warfare is relatively inexpensive.
Mm.
It doesn't take much for it to do. It's resource light. It's finance light. And so for the Russians, why not? And anything that can, and if it takes up, say, for example, by exploiting Irish-UK tensions, for example, or tensions along the border between the north and the south, then that would be useful in removing UK bandwidth, bearing in mind that the UK has taken something of a lead in combating the Russian threat. So I it doesn't surprise me in the slightest when you tell me that the not so much that the Russians are coming, because I don't want to make it sound paranoid, but quite clearly they have been probing, and they will look to find out where it works, and they're not stupid. They learn from their mistakes, and if it's something does not work, they will try another approach.
How effective has the European Union and NATO been in its responses to countering Russian aggression and bolstering regional security? I mean, the public are reading, they're being told a lot about this, but I get a sense, and I don't know whether you agree with this, James, that there's a sense of fear enveloping all of this now, that there's almost a sense that there are events happening that certain elements of NATO and the military alliance across Europe are recognizing and taking action on, but that their political overlords maybe don't understand fully, and certainly the public are some of them might be aware of it, of course, but largely they're ignorant of these issues, but that there's something happening and the atmosphere is changing.
Well, the EU and NATO have obviously been caught napping. I mean, in the EU in particular, then I mean, there was a tendency to play down the Russian threat, to try to, there were EU-Russia Council meetings, and they, even though they were going nowhere, they were flogging a dead horse there. And it was really, again, in spite of what Russia did in Syria, in spite of the invasion of Georgia in 2008, then they still thought that they could be brought inside into various different, and the NATO-Russia Council is another example, that this would simply be a stepping stone towards ever greater union, in a sense. And Putin, by the way, was talking, and I remember, again, in the Tucker Carlson interview the other day, he mentioned that, you know, at one point he says he was interested in joining NATO. But the reality is, of course, is that they simply didn't hold sufficient values that are required to join these international organizations, these multilateral organizations. So whilst in a way, Russia has traditionally been more interested in capitals than multilaterals, then actually, because NATO is seen by the Kremlin as being an inherently anti-Russian organization, nothing of a sort, of course, it's a defensive organization, as we know, then actually it is simply Russia's mission to destroy NATO. And it feels it can do that, incidentally, in Ukraine. Even though Ukraine is not in NATO, then if it will be seen as a defeat. If Ukraine falls, if it's not given the sufficient weaponry, if it's not given the necessary finance, and it falls, then that will ultimately be a blow to NATO, which has pledged to protect it, not in the Article 5 sense, but to come to its assistance in all ways possible. And if it fails, then ultimately that is a huge failure for NATO. So that is you know, one of Russia's key priorities. It's not just to bring these other countries back into the fold, but it is to destroy what it regards as anti-Russian multilateral organizations. So I think these multilaterals are scrabbling to get to grips with the scale and complexity of the problem. I think they do understand it more nowadays. That's certainly true as far as Josep Borrell and Ursula von der Leyen and Charles Michel are concerned. They have absolutely been up front and foremost as far as in terms of, you know, being supportive of Ukraine and talking and being open about the Russian threat far more so than many of the member states themselves. And NATO has been, to be honest with NATO, it's been more concerned with its reviewing its doctrine, reviewing its policies, reviewing and ultimately, I suppose, trying to protect itself against this sort of oncoming storm, which has kind of failed really to adequately confront. But obviously, we know there are now issues of enlargement on the table, both NATO and EU, particularly the EU, where Ukraine and Moldova have been invited into accession talks. And there are discussions about what might be possible at the NATO summit in Washington, I don't think Ukraine will be invited in, of course, then. That's almost certainly not due to US and German objections, but maybe something in between. Maybe there can be some compromise and maybe there'll be some give when that comes around in July.
What are the implications of Russia's energy dominance in certain parts of the world, particularly in the context of its natural gas supplies? I know it's under sanction now, but it's continuing to sell oil and other energy to places like India. Has this war and have these sanctions forced Russia to reorientate itself in some ways and kind of strengthen it almost, because it's having to go through this difficult process, but it can see an end to it because it's coming out as a more competent actor?
Yeah, I don't know about competent, but I do agree that Russia's reliance on fossil fuels has obviously had to take a beating, and it's had to compensate. And where it's compensated is in its military industry, military-industrial complex, and that has, to a certain extent, saved its economy. Of course, its economy is under sanctions, and although there's a lot of loopholes and workarounds, and we do find Russian oil and gas inside Western states because of these transgressions, then I think, in a sense, it's come at a useful time for Russia, as the world was turning away from hydrocarbons and towards some green transition. But Russia has also been forced away from this as well. Yes, it can still sell elsewhere, and it needs that to just keep going. But at a discount. If there's no competition, then these countries know that they can demand a much lower price from Russia. And there's an oil price cap, so ultimately there's only so much they can earn from it. So I don't think that Russia is the energy superpower that it once was. It has now got stranded assets. It's now not able to extract what it would wish due to the absence of Western technology inside Russia. Very few Western energy firms have anything to do with Russia anymore, or they are extricating themselves, having been overexposed. It's not really going anywhere on the green transition itself. It's not been able to invest in that, of course, since it's now consumed by war. So yes, it is a lever of reduced influence, but unfortunately, that has been replaced by a mobilization of the economy and the society towards production for the war. Now that's not able to make up for it. The revenues there are not as great as they were when it was selling hydrocarbons to the West, but it is able to. The Russians are asked to belt tighten and self sacrifice, literally in the most extreme way. But there used to be a sort of a social contract between the Russians and between the Kremlin and the people that was, don't get involved in politics and we will make your lives richer. But in fact, that was true, because obviously for the first, shall we say, 12, 13, 14 years of Putin's presidency, 24 years in now, of course, for the first 14 years, then Russians did get richer year on year. But that all did change roughly 10 years ago, because we're marking this week not just the second year anniversary of the war, but we're also marking 10 years of Euromaidan, since the revolution of dignity in Kiev, Ukraine. So Russia is trying very hard, pedaling desperately under the water to maintain stability, despite not holding the cards that it once did. But at the same time, don't forget, I mean, I must say, I'm not actually predicting, you know, great instability in Russia. They're managing to do this reasonably successfully, whether that's because people are a little scared, or whether it is because of the repressions, or whether it is because they believe in the purpose and the glory, the greater glory of Russia, and that this is a viable and legitimate war, then that is at the moment, and for how long we can debate, sustaining the regime and by extension, its life economy.
Considering everything that's happening, we've had Donald Trump kind of ridicule NATO, and I'm kind of paraphrasing what he said, but he basically urged or suggested that no one should care if Russia attacked NATO states if they hadn't paid their dues, etc. Given all of this, considering the evolving security threats now posed by Russia, how crucial is it that there is significant collaboration among European nations and their allies to confront this problem?
I don't know. I'm a bit of a heretic here. I feel that obviously there's always disunity in the West, and even within the EU and NATO, and we see this most obviously with Hungary and perhaps a little bit with Slovakia, and it might come elsewhere in places we can talk about. But I think it's more important to talk about coalitions of the willing and what can be done, and maybe with a smaller number of states, rather than to be so scared of that one country may drop out, or that you must have unanimity. That seems like a slightly false grail. And so, of course, again, it goes back to the point about Russia exposing fissures and cracks already existing in the West. And I think we just have to accept that that a lot of Western European countries have got different histories, different cultures. They're starting from different starting points towards Russia, but nonetheless, there is a war to be won here. So to me, we spend too much time on unanimity and not enough on what can be done amongst the richer and more militarily capable or better stockpiled countries. That would strike me as being an alternative and more fruitful way to go, because in a sense, you know, we're never all going to agree. It's just too hard.
I see where you're coming from on that. So looking ahead, and I don't want to put you in the hot seat now, but I'm going to.
Okay.
What are the potential scenarios or developments that could shape Russia-European relations and, I suppose, Ireland's security calculus in the coming years? What way do you see this all playing out, or is it impossible to tell?
Yeah, I mean, I hate to say it. I mean, it's the blatantly obvious, but so much is dependent upon the outcome of the war. And right now we're in this situation of a protracted warfare, or some people call it forever war. And it's true that there is at the moment no immediate end in sight, according to most military experts. But that calculus could change. Both parties do have a theory of victory, whereby they are hoping that, Russia is hoping that obviously Ukraine's funding and equipment and kit will dry out, not just courtesy of Donald Trump, but courtesy of Ukraine fatigue. Ukraine, meanwhile, is hoping that it can survive long enough through 2024 to launch a new counteroffensive in 2025 and punch through in ways in which it was not able to in 2023. So, your question was, you know, how is this going to affect European security? And the reality is that if Russia achieves any kind of substantial victory in this current war taking place in Ukraine, then the entire security dynamic of Western Europe and security order is called into question, because it will embolden Russia. It will be encouraged to try new things in new places. Obviously, first of all, and with most muscularity, in the post-Soviet states, you know, Moldova or Georgia being next potentially. But beyond that, it ultimately means that all these different ways in which we've discussed that Russia penetrates Western countries, it will continue and will be reinforced. So I think that we possibly don't talk enough about, you know, look, it'll make it clear that, for example, that nuclear weapons work, because we've been intimidated by nuclear weapons rhetoric. So people will, so there'll be increased search for nuclear capability. It will mean that there'll be a flood of Ukrainians departing Ukraine if it comes under the Russian hammer, and that means that that could lead to an increase in far right sentiment in various different European countries. So there are all sorts of ways whereby our own inaction could lead to a Russian victory, which will have ripple effects. You know, obviously on trade, there's the grain issue where Russia would control that to a much greater extent, up to 70% of the world's grain supply. The damage is quite hard to calculate. By the way, there is an alternative solution, by the way, whereby Russia loses this war, and it does bring about some change, as losing wars has done in history. And then you begin to see the grassroots, the green shoots of change in Russia, and maybe that's something that can be developed and work with. I only say maybe because, of course, that's what we thought in the 1990s, and we were so wrong.
Absolutely. That's the understatement, if ever there was one. So that concludes another insightful episode of The Dark State. I'd like to thank James Nixie for sharing his expertise and offering invaluable insights into the complex dynamics of Russia's threat to Europe and its implications for Ireland. Be sure to tune in next time as we continue to explore the security issues which threaten Ireland and the modern world. Until we speak again, do take care.